Hello, children. This is Ben. Oh, it's Zach.
And this is, Ben.
And welcome to the Movie Vault. Today, we have a very, very important and special film that we're going to be reviewing here in this cold, dark basement on a nice Tuesday morning. We watched it last night, so don't be surprised if we don't seem prepared, so we don't really have much research on the back.
It's not because we aren't prepared. It just doesn't appear that way.
Sure, because we are acting. Just as Gloria Swanson was so gloriously acting in this film. So we're going to review Sunset Boulevard, which is a 1950 American black comedy in film noir. That's what it says on Wikipedia. And it was directed and co-written by Billy Wilder, who has done many great films, and then also co-written by Charles Brackett. And it was named after this one big giant famous street in Hollywood that lots of famous people lived on called Sunset Boulevard. And the reason I picked this film is because it's kind of like the baseline story that Inland Empire was that Inland Empire kind of ripped apart and shredded to pieces to make its meta story. So, in honor of David Lynch, maybe currently my favorite director, I chose to watch Sunset Boulevard. So, obviously, it stars many great notable actors that, if you've seen a lot of films from the 50s, have a big staple. So, William Holden, Gloria Swanson, who is actually known for having a lot of silent films beforehand, Eric von Stroheim, Nancy Olsen, Fred Clark, Lloyd Goff, I don't know, and Jack Webb. So, and just, yeah, what'd you think?
It was amazing, and I think this is the kind of movie you show people to give them a new perspective on films in like the 1940s and 1950s, because I think sure, there's enough of movies in that era that probably were like mediocre, not that good, that you could watch and be like, oh, like it was a weird time for filmmaking, but you watch a movie like this and you're like, wow, there was like a lot of richness and layers that a lot of people don't give this era credit for, I feel like.
Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, this film is a character study, I'm thinking. It tells a great story. It has some great characters. And even supposedly the main character, and I would argue he's not the main character, William Holden's character, is not who the story is about. The story is about a concept, an idea, almost like an obsession that the center of this film, and Gloria Swanson just embodies her character of Norma Desmond very, very, very well to encapsulate this the theme, and I think there are a few themes that we can talk about regarding what this film represents and what it's actually about, because it could be about many things. I think it's not just a one thing, which is why you said it's multi-layered, and I agree. So, and this is something else we saw. So, we also just watched another film for next week's episode. And you just told me, Ben, that a lot of these famous films are about films. Just because people who like movies really like movies, and they are attracted to movies about movies.
Yeah, and the people who direct the movies love movies.
That's
so
true.
So, they it's sort of like a self-loving circle of... because it continues on. I mean, as much as Zach didn't like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, all that movie is just like a tribute to old films. And old films now is like 1960s, which was called the golden era of Hollywood, at least to some people. But they were already like kind of glorifying film in the 1920s, when film had been around for like only about 20 years or so. A little bit more than 20 years. So,
sure, it didn't take very long. Short run, I mean, it's been around 100 years, right?
Yeah.
So, with the short run of film in general, you really have to start somewhere. I mean, at some point, you just got to be like, oh, what's enough history for us to start referencing old things? And movies, the nature of movies are referential, right? Every single film is built upon the films before it. So, I mean, this film is built upon films before this. I mean, we could just keep going back. And in the Movie Vault, we've been kind of doing a lot of films that have influenced other films that we've done or other films that we like recently. So this obviously influenced Inland Empire, among many other things.
No, we're already self-referential.
I'm just saying.
We're taking
to our old episodes.
Our old episodes, and we're, like, digging into them in a new layer by reviewing a new movie that's older than the movie that we reviewed.
And it's probably unfair to Billy Wilder and everybody in this film to only kind of reference that this is influenced Inland Empire.
Yeah, but, probably not.
But
especially considering that this movie probably had a lot more impact on the world in general than Inland Empire did. But
yeah,
maybe to us film nerds, Inland Empire stands out as a bit as more ambitious even than this movie. Which is saying something, because I think this movie is pretty ambitious.
It's ambitious, but it's easy to understand.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of this film, what makes it great is it really changed how storytelling took place in Hollywood. Just kind of the idea of how do you tell a story? Is it through a main character? Is it a story? Is it a plot? Is it a theme? But this film really doesn't center around necessarily just the plot, just characters. It's really about an obsession, I'd say. It's about a theme. Specifically, and I think that was kind of a big shift in Hollywood, so that films could be about, I don't know, I just think it influenced some other films that we'll be going into in the next. We're doing a small series in the 50s
or 60s
sorry 60s coming up next, right?
Yeah,
so we'll do one at 60 after 63. Sherlock
Jr. Then we'll do our 60s
series. Oh, you're right. Yes. So we're going to go back to the 20s first. Okay, so I lied. So, but in a couple weeks, come back and listen to our episodes. And if you're listening, it might already be up there, most likely.
Yeah.
So, anyway, Sunset Boulevard. Ben, what was your biggest takeaway? Just one big takeaway.
Fame is a hell of a drug.
Yeah, okay. Why do you say that?
Well, it may be more than just fame, but the last scene in Sunset Boulevard is its most iconic, and it really, I think, summarizes what the film is about. It's about someone who had the attention of the world and lost it, and how once you reach that peak and you fall from it, if you don't like reorient your life, that's all you'll ever want again. So it literally is a drug, because you know, someone can get so famous, but there's always a level that you will never be able to get more famous than a certain point. And eventually that starts to tail off, usually, because there's other people who are still continuing to get famous. For Norma Desmond, this was a literal change in technology that shifted her out, and her either unwillingness or inability, might have been kind of more inability, to adapt to that, because she may not have been talented as a vocal actress. And so instead of choosing to move on and move into other things, which she references a little bit, that she's become kind of a businesswoman in her older age, but instead of like leaning into that, she just chooses to live in the past. Mm-hmm. And maybe there's multiple lessons other than just the fame, sort of about living in the past, sort of the idea that your life only matters when you're young. There's that quote where I think Joe says, what's the point of being 50 when you're trying to be 25.
It's like being 50 isn't so bad, but it's miserable when you're trying to be 25.
Yeah, exactly. So there could be sort of this like a desire to be forever youthful that's there. At the end of it, it's about her living in the fantasy of like, what it doesn't matter how it happens, as long as I come back into the limelight.
Yeah. And I even think maybe, without acknowledging it face on, this film does also address a big aspect of mental illness, honestly.
Yeah, it does.
And just how, I mean, even those last few scenes where she's just in a state of shock after she shot Joe, and she's just not talking to anybody, and all she hears is the word cameras, and she turns around, she's like, Max, are the cameras here?
and Max, and even like, the mental illness that Max is experiencing, because that guy is...
No, Max is worse than normal. We'll get to Max, okay? He's a sicko. I'm just telling you. But Norma, she's in this just absolute catatonic state where she cannot live and breathe or function without knowing that there is a purpose And for her, purpose is the limelight, cameras, the spotlight, right? So, and then the only way to get her to go downstairs to be, I guess, arrested is for her to be having those cameras on them. And, you know, at the end, just like Joe got what he wanted, he got the pool. She got what she wanted. She got the cameras. And neither of them got what they wanted exactly the way that they wanted it, unfortunately. Right. But I think in Norma's case, a lot of that is mental illness. But I think it maybe developed into mental illness after secluding herself, isolating herself, and just letting herself be obsessed without any accountability. And then people like Max just feeding into these things.
Max essentially enabling her and like worsening everything by playing into what she wanted.
And it's just so funny when we found out Max was her first husband.
I was like, has the word cuck been invented by 1950? Because that might describe Max a little bit. But it seems like a little bit deeper than that, though.
There seems like a
big level of guilt that Max feels for like Norma losing her fame or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, he takes responsibility for her rise. He didn't necessarily take responsibility for her fall, did he?
No, he didn't.
Yeah, I think a lot of that was moving from the silent film era to the talkies.
He didn't take responsibility. But it is odd because you get this feeling that she kind of abandoned him for the other director, the guy who's in charge, DeMille, who's in charge of Paramount.
Yeah.
Like, it's like he directed her early pictures, she got famous, and then she left.
Yeah.
And you don't know where in there she left him as husband and wife.
Yeah.
And got her second husband.
That's a good thought. How did he end up that way? I think Max kind of ended up in that position the same way that Joe did, almost. Because I know Max.
Yeah.
Because Max was married to her.
He kind of like reeled her in.
And then directed her, right? So they were married first, and then he directed her. And then they got famous.
And then she probably left him at that point.
Yeah, because she got way more famous than he ever did. And then he stopped directing because he wanted his wife, right? Because he was jealous when Joe was dancing with her. So he has some affection for her. And I think she kind of has this almost God complex or this self-absorbed nature where she has to have the guy sleep in another room, you know, kind of be a little bit subordinate to her and just be around when she needs her, when she needs him.
It's kind of like, and she's also like paying for his lifestyle, which is what gets Joe sucked in as someone who lived in a one-bedroom apartment, couldn't pay for his car.
Yeah,
like he gets sucked into this high society, even though it comes with basically living in a prison.
Yeah, yeah, and I mean she's kind of luring this guy in, and I think she probably did that with Max too, if I had to imagine. She didn't lure him back in. Yeah, I'm saying lure him back in, not originally, because they were married before she got rich.
Which you have to imagine she was like a different person at that point. Although from the indications, it was a little fishy because it sounded like she was like 16 or 17 when she started getting famous. So this might have been sort of different era, but different generation, but you got to think Max was a decent amount older than her when she was 16 and they may have already been married. So that probably was already started out as kind of a bad dynamic. But so the interesting thing about Max, his character, is that he's played by Eric von Stroheim, who was a silent film director, most known for his 1924 movie Greed. Now, the interesting thing about Eric von Stroheim is that as silent films got closed out or, you know, went out of style, essentially, with the rise of being able to have audio equipment and talking in movies, he actually became more of an actor. So he stopped directing movies after like 1933. And I knew I recognized the name. Initially, I got it super mixed up and thought it was Max von Sydow, who's in The Seventh Seal, which is completely...
Yeah, you said that last week.
Yeah, which is completely not the right person. But Eric von Stroheim was in a movie I've watched, and he was in The Grand Illusion, which is a Jean Renoir movie.
Yeah.
Because I think he's French or worked in... he might not be French, but he worked in France. And he plays one of the main characters in that movie, who is Captain von Rosenthal. And it's a great performance. I watched that in one of the film classes I took in college. One of the two film classes I took in college, which is more than most nursing majors, I want to point out.
Yeah, he's not a film major.
but that's a great movie, and he's great performance in it. But he was acting all the way up to, you know, there was no break in his acting career. He worked all the way up to but it's interesting. Billy Wilder, I'm sure, cast him partly because of his history, just like he did Gloria Swanson.
Same thing with Gloria Swanson, where she was an actual silent film star, had all of these background just had a lot going for her, and then when the films switched to talkies, she really kind of became a lesser known actress, and then this film brought her back, and she ended up winning a Golden Globe for it and everything, and this is what she's actually known for now.
Which is funny, because she kind of gets what the actor she portrays does not get in this movie, which is like actual recognition and like a return.
Yeah. Which is probably why she got the return and why she ended up getting a Golden Globe, is because her acting in this is so good, because she probably understands what it's like to be a lost artist like that. I mean, back then they weren't as so postmodern to say artist. They would say actress or actor.
Right.
But
right.
For her, it was more of a, I understand what this woman is going through and the pain that she felt. Let me take that to the most immature conclusion that I can, rather than controlling it the way that I did in real life.
You know that DeMille is a real guy?
Yep.
That's crazy. Mm-hmm. I did not know that. So she actually also had a contract with Paramount.
So she actually did films with DeMille. Gloria Swanson.
Is DeMille... Oh, no. He's probably dead. Or... really old, so he's not playing himself in this movie, right?
Yeah, because he was a filmmaker between 1914 and 1958, so he's either dead or
He would have still been alive, but
oldest man living. Yeah, at that time he was still alive. No, he died in 1959. But yeah, so I mean, these are all, I mean, Billy Wilder's taking a real story, fictionalizing it, twisting it a little bit, adding a little bit more drama, adding a death, obviously, to a real situation. So he literally saw Gloria Swanson's situation and was like, I'm going to make a movie about that. Using real characters, having someone be her director who's actually a real director. And then also he brought in William Holden, who was, in the 1950s, he was like the big star. So he won tons of awards, you know, so he won the best actor for Stalag 17. I don't know if that's Stalag.
He was in Bridge in the River Kwai, right? Or yes. Bridge on the River Kwai.
Yep.
Yeah, which is a very famous movie.
Sabrina, Picnic, The Wild Bunch. So he's in a lot of these great, amazing old movies. And then he was also in some television shows, like I said, so Stalag. But he was like the draw. So he was like probably the only one not from the era before.
Yeah.
So he was known for his talkies rather than the silent films. The rest of these actors were kind of known from this older era of film. And the 1950s really were not too far off, like a decade and a half off of when talkies started becoming big, right? I don't know what year that was, but...
It seems like it was somewhere around 1930 to like 34. In that era, like, was when things kind of switched over. Maybe it was started earlier than that, but like the movie M came out in like 1930. It's kind of like a mix between silent and talking.
So. I think it was like late 20s, but I think you're right. It got famous in the 30s is kind of when they took off. I think at first people were hesitant. Like, why would people want to hear talking?
Yeah, it's
in
like
films?
Anything that changes. Yeah. It takes a little bit for it to like take off. But then once it does, it's like,
oh yeah,
there's no turning back.
Yeah. So anyway, that's kind of the background to some of these characters. I mean, that adds a lot to it, I think. I think knowing that these people actually have portrayed, they're basically portraying themselves, except for William Holden's character. I think everybody's really just playing someone that they've already been at some point in their lives.
Yeah, I'm not sure what William Holden has ever been a struggling writer in his life, but
no.
Everyone else, yes.
And that doesn't you know, take away from his performance.
You know the Waxworks, characters that are like, the who they play bridge with in the movie?
Yeah.
Guess who one of the guys is, who is one of the Waxworks?
Who?
We saw him recently. It was Buster Keaton. He was in this movie.
But wait, seriously?
Yeah.
Did you just figure that out?
Yeah. So he said, Norman plays a card game with a group of actors known as the Waxworks. They included Buster Keaton, H.B. Warner, and Anna Q. Nielsen.
Wow.
So
we just watched a Buster Keaton film this morning.
So it goes deep, the amount of reference that they're... I'm assuming that... Let's see. Yeah, no, yeah, he's credited in the movie. Yeah, as a bridge player.
Hmm.
So, I think they had different names for him, which is why we didn't go, oh, Buster Keaton.
Well, but, maybe, because those were her, she said those were her silent film co-stars.
And so, and quite literally, they were.
Yeah. So, those are some of the three biggest names. If Chaplin was in this film, if he lived long enough.
Yeah. They would have gotten him if they could.
Yeah. Maybe. Maybe he was too big for them. It's not me that got smaller. It's the movies that got smaller.
He's like the only guy who is so big that his name has sort of outlived
the Well, yeah, you change. Put a mustache on anything, and it's Hitler or Charlie Chaplin. So, one or the other. But, yeah. I'd say my first reaction was pretty similar to yours. I'd say it was largely about the concept of obsession. And what that can drive you to do, and how that can change your psyche, how that can change your lifestyle, and how every single thing can be oriented around an obsession, and how that affects other people as well, especially family and people who you are almost holding hostage. So, to serve your desires, which is, you know, a twisted, horrible thing. But we don't realize we're doing it sometimes because we're just so focused and tunnel visioned. But it reminded me a little bit of films like Whiplash or what's the other one? The Swan. That's about a very obsessed.
Oh, Black Swan.
Black Swan's about the dancer, right?
Yep.
Yeah, they're very obsessed. It's a lot of.
Yeah, actually, you could see similarities in that one. Yeah.
I just think of like those characters are so obsessed that they just they affect everyone around them in horrible ways. This is like that.
I don't know. These.
What was his obsession?
Being fat. Okay, that wasn't. That's more of an issue in his life than an obsession.
He's obsessed with it. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I think the biggest takeaway I had from this film was let the past go. That sounds like a really easy thing to say. A Disney Channel. Type of revelation, but also it's like you're not special at the end of the day. We're not. She says, "I'm a star." People don't leave stars, and she gets like just so blinded into everything. You know, when you think you're special, then that really does blind you.
Yeah. Well, and fame is a strange object of desire because what is it truly? It's that you can walk into any room and people will automatically have a extremely positive reaction to your presence. You don't have to earn anything anymore. You just walk in and everyone loves you.
You're right. It's almost like an investment. It's like oil. You know, she said she's got oil and pumping. You just get to a point where money is making itself because you just put your name on a brand, right? And you're just making a ton of money. I think of Rihanna, or I don't know. I always think of Rihanna first, but like all of her cool things that she does with clothing and stuff like that. It's just like, or Kanye with shoes or Michael Jordan. You just stamp your name on it and you're making millions and millions and millions of dollars.
Right.
That's not obviously why. That's not the core of fame. That's a pleasantry of fame. But I think the core of fame is if other people think I'm important, then I'm important.
Yeah.
And I don't ascribe value to ourselves. And obviously, that can be very unhealthy too. If you just describe self-love is not the best love, okay? That's not.
No.
I'm saying other people's love are also not the best love. So if you ascribe your value based off of what other people say about you, or the amount of people who enjoy watching your films, in this case, then when they inevitably stop caring about you, because you can't care about someone that you don't know and be obsessed with them for your entire life. You know what I mean? So yeah. Her fans eventually get over her because that's natural and it destroys her. And obviously she's stuck in the state after that. because her worth has gone down, and she's trying to hold on to that worth and not let go.
And the strange thing about actors and actresses is that there's no other job where you, like, normally people are like, they'll watch something and they'll be like, oh yeah, that person's good at their job, and that's kind of, they respect them. But with actors, and I guess you could say athletes to an extent too, like they are doing a job. They train and they are performing. They're trying to be someone else, but sometimes being someone else is like an extension of themselves, like in this movie. But then it's interesting, like, this has been true since films began, but people like latch on to like the actors behind the actual character. So they like the character, but then they're like, I also like this actor and I want to know everything about them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an interesting part of humanity. Like, there has to have been some aspects of that before there was an entertainment industry, right?
Like, I'm not sure if I thought about that. Kind of like, what's going on behind the scenes?
Yeah, like, what is it about actors and actresses that people, like, really latch on to? Because I guess we've gotten to the point where we really admire directors, and I think the reason why is because you can see their, like...
It's their concepts going into our brain.
Yeah, but at the same time, I don't really care what Martin Scorsese is, you know, where he's eating dinner at, or... really anything about his relationships. That's true. Maybe I do care about that a little bit, but it doesn't seem as obsessive as how people you know, get into, like, now it's not even actors and actresses, it's like just like people who are famous. They're famous for being famous sake.
Usher.
Like the Kardashians. Usher.
Mm-hmm. I think Usher is only famous because he knows other famous people.
Well, he made the song Yeah, so.
Yeah, I guess.
I mean, you hear that song sometimes.
Sometimes. In a mall.
Yeah.
In a Five Guys.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I'm saying Rihanna's much better.
Oh, well, yeah.
I also don't like
her. Well, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Anywho, I think there is this draw to know, why is this person making this film? What is going on behind the scenes? And naturally, as humans, we always ask those questions.
Yeah, who, what, where, when, why. We're just curious.
We're curious little beings. Sometimes too curious, you know?
Right.
For we our are. Own good.
We are.
But what this film does well is it takes real concepts and puts them together and mixes them well in the story. I think one of the best parts of the story was just seeing her state, which was already poor, just decline even further. I think that was just the best part, just seeing the fall. There wasn't even a rise. The rise was totally, talked about. It was
totally
talked about
off screen.
Yeah. And to see her just get worse and worse and worse because she's putting her value on how Joe thinks about her rather than her fans, right? And that just destroys her when Joe doesn't love her because she is just a crazy woman with tons of baggage. I mean, she's cutting herself, she's trying to kill herself, and just a woman that would be it would be hard to be with that woman, genuinely. Like, I don't even think Joe disliked her that much. I think Joe was just like, this is too much. I have to get out of here. And he said it's like an odd prison. He described it something like that. Because it's not like a real prison, it's like I'm trapped, but I'm not at the same time.
Yeah, because Joe, he escapes, and then he goes to this party, but then she harms herself, and he's like, and he feels guilty. So he's like, I got to go back.
Yeah.
So that's the prison. It's more of a psychological prison
in
that regard. And she knows that she can manipulate him in that way. It is ahead of its time, I think, in dealing. I didn't think about this as much last night, but in dealing with mental health issues.
Oh, yeah.
I don't think, like, how many other movies in the 1950s dealt with cutting? You know,
yeah, it's a real problem. Mental health issues are extremely, extremely serious, and I think a lot of times there are people who don't take them seriously, and I think there are a lot of times that there are, in our culture today, we say everything's a mental illness, right?
Yeah, we kind of have mental illness fatigue.
Yeah,
because well, maybe it's a mental illness to be kind of a mental illness hypochondriac, where you start like associating every problem that you have in your life with a mental illness.
I think that's the WebMD problem.
I would call it might be a mental illness in and of itself.
Yeah. Well, Okay, if we're getting late. We can't
here.
Describe every sin as a mental illness.
Well,
okay?
That's what I'm saying.
We have to take responsibility at some point. That. But there are some chemical imbalances, truly. Right. In Gloria Swanson's case, I think it was like she was originally just a complete sinner, just horribly, horribly. Just she acted horribly because even DeMille said at the end of her career she was pretty much unbearable, right?
Yeah.
And she was just this nasty woman at the end. She didn't start out that way.
You have to think that's part of the reason that they also could use the transition to kind of push her out the door, right?
Yes.
Because it didn't sound like she was a pleasant person to work with by the end.
Yeah. So then when she kind of – when her demise started to happen and her state started to get a little bit worse is when – she got more unbearable. So it kind of started with her, and then the mental illness came out of that, right?
Right.
So that and can that can also
the isolation
happen.
And the living into
and listen, neither of us are doc. Like we're not. I'm not a doctor. You're not a nurse yet.
No.
You're much closer than I am to being in. And we're not professionals in this in these areas as well.
No. And even
this isn't
so,
a mental health podcast. Yeah. There are plenty of those to go to. Most of them will tell you nonsense. So this is a movie podcast, but this movie is about mental illness.
And we just, you know, it is good to highlight that. I think people do get fatigue from hearing about people's mental illnesses. But if I think working in the medical world, even in the most mundane of jobs, you realize that there's people have lots of issues. And sometimes if you're blessed enough to, I mean, everyone that you're around will have problems. That's unavoidable. But if you're blessed enough to be in a stable family where your parents have stayed together and have a pretty good relationship and they have pretty good relationships with their parents and their in-laws, like that's not all that common. And so you can be kind of sheltered from the rest of the world where there is just so many messed up relationships, and then that messes with people, the more messed up relationships that you're in. And sometimes it's unavoidable. Like sometimes it's not even your fault that the relationships get messed up.
And sometimes when you're raised on a certain type of relationship, you don't realize that that might not be the healthiest.
Yeah, the healthiest. Or
I wouldn't call it the norm necessarily.
Yeah, norm is a bad word. Yeah, it might not be the healthiest.
It's a bad word, Ben.
No, it is because you have to define normal somehow.
What is the norm? Yeah, anyway, so.
What you hope the norm is, maybe. Anyway, now we're getting in the weeds of definitions, but
yeah. So Gloria Swanson's character—I keep saying Gloria Swanson, Norma Desmond. Yeah, that's the best part of this film is just seeing that the fall, and really, I think a lot of it is just her self-value. So seeing that on screen is a powerful thing because I think we all fall for those types of things all the time, maybe in much more minor ways, but maybe sometimes in our lives as much. Or as maybe as dramatic as she is, we ascribe value based on what other people think about us. I would love to talk about Max.
I would also love to talk about Max.
What was this guy's deal?
It's a good question. He might be the most confusing character in the movie because it's hard to see what his angle is in this. Other than he almost doesn't seem like a real person in parts of the movie.
Unless he really wants Norma.
That must be the underlying...
But how can you just be her butler for years, like decades?
That's what I'm saying. He's a cuck. Like, he's literally... He's being subservient voluntarily. Like, and I don't even know that he has an end goal at this point to be with her. Or this is... It's like almost like this is the closest thing that he can have to being with her, and so that's what he wants.
Probably.
And, like, somehow he's getting satisfaction out of... Like allowing her fantasy to
perpetrate. Let's not go down the pathways of how he's receiving satisfaction.
I'm not saying that kind of satisfaction. I'm just saying like some sort of.
I mean, I'm thinking like, what is he actually trying to get out of it? So, I don't know. Yeah. Anyway, he's crazy. I don't understand. He had a successful career, gave it away because he was miserable without her.
No, we don't know whether he's lying when he says he could have had a longer career.
Like, I mean, he did a few films.
Yeah. Oh, I guess you're right. It sounded like he might have quit in the silent film era, maybe, in the middle of it, because that's when he was directing.
Yeah, maybe. But I think he said he did quit to go follow her because he was miserable without her.
Which that's odd.
Yeah.
What is it about this lady that makes people miserable without her? I mean, maybe he really believes she was the greatest actress.
Like maybe, or she
talks about that. He says, "Madame was the greatest," or something like that. He always calls her Madame.
Yeah, Madame. Maybe it was her her beauty treatments. I don't know. It could have been looks.
Yeah. Seems like more than that.
For you and I, we're a little biased. We're much younger than her, and this is a film from the 1950s, so the style is different. So we're very biased to say, no, I wouldn't go for that. I wouldn't quit my career.
Yeah, we're more in the Joe Gillis role. Like, yeah. Maybe I take all the money.
And the ladies are obsessed with us throughout the film.
Yeah. I was like, what is it about this Joe guy that is just like this lady that he meets? When you see that, we started watching the movie, and then I had a whole episode where I passed out, so we couldn't finish it. And then we rewatched it again this past week. And that lady came in the reader's room, and the second time I saw her come in when we restarted it yesterday, I was like, she's definitely coming back at this movie. Like, in the 1950s, they didn't just have characters that showed up that didn't come back. Like, mm-hmm. That is the funny thing about older movies. Maybe, yeah, in newer movies, it's like there's more like cameos or like random moments, it feels like, that are purposeless. Mm-hmm. But you're like, every character who's introduced, you're like, yeah, they have a purpose.
Yeah. Well, good. So that's a good, she's also a great actress. Nancy Ann Olsen was the actress for, I'm getting her name wrong. Anyway, the other girl.
The other love interest.
This is not good.
She was not as interesting of a character.
Yeah.
She was, but...
For only having two women in this film, I feel obligated to know. Anyway, I'll let you find it. She did really well. I think her part really was just to be the...
She was Betty Schaefer.
Miss Schaefer. Yeah. She was supposed to be kind of the other life that Joe could have. The other life, the girl that Joe desired, the other situation, the one that's safer than Norma's situation.
Much prettier.
I mean, that's subjective.
Much younger.
Not according to Max. She's not prettier.
Max might be a little biased. But also much less stable financially.
Yeah, I mean, she's also going after Joe, who's not financially stable.
And she also possibly represents a younger version of Joe, because he said... He reminds her of when he was a young writer and he was ambitious and thinking about how he could get these pictures and how he could get his way into the industry. And we're supposed to look at Joe as someone who did have some success and then has now fallen upon hard times. But and also he realizes that writers, they get their name in the credits, but nobody remembers them because they don't see them on screen. Hmm. So they don't get any fame. So his ceiling as a writer is not near what he's getting by being with Norma Desmond.
Yeah.
So that's sort of the what does that play? So going with Gloria is, or not Gloria, going with Betty is like the, I'm going back to my old life.
Yeah, I could see that. I think.
But it's also a more standard life. That's like you find somebody that you love and who's, well, I wouldn't even say around his age because... I think he's older than her by a decent amount.
But yeah, I think he is too. That's just a different generation, you know?
Different generation. That's still how Hollywood is, I mean, yeah. To this day.
Ooh, maybe we've had a few movements, though, since then to weed some of that out. Anyway, I think, because at the beginning of the film, it was hard to see if Norma actually was in love with Joe or if she was using him to. At the end, we found out like it really was about her movie, but she also really loved Joe. And because she needed her own value. It was really a selfish, leeching, sucking, blood-sucking vampire type of relationship.
She really needs positive affirmation.
Yeah.
From everyone.
So I think you're right. It's instability. And it's also like a love triangle at the same time. And Joe's honestly at some point taking advantage of both.
Yes.
And then at the end, I think when he's rude to Miss Schaefer, I'm just going to say Schaefer, I forget her first name. I think he does it just so that he can go back to Norma. I don't know. Not because he loves Norma. I don't know.
But then he immediately says he's leaving.
Leaving.
So it's so very confusing what Joe's play is there.
Because I think he wanted to do that show in front of Norma so Norma wouldn't kill herself, maybe?
Yeah.
Maybe?
Maybe.
Because at the end, he says that's between you and yourself, and he says that would be quite a show if you killed yourself.
Because what happens is they have this romantic moment. He kisses Betty. He goes back to Norma's house. Norma is immediately... She's already read something that Betty wrote, and she already knows she exists. And he calls her and is trying to, like, get her to not like Joe because of their sort of relationship that they're in that she doesn't know about.
Yeah.
And then he takes kind of control and says, come see what it is. And he puts on this kind of, like, big show of, like, talking about how empty the house is and how he can't go with Betty because he wouldn't have his designer suits. And you're like, wait, I didn't know Joe actually.
But he really actually doesn't care because he leaves him behind in the next scene.
Right.
So I think that was obviously a show, but why did he put on that show? I think it was to make sure Norma didn't kill herself, honestly.
Yeah.
Maybe. Maybe he actually deeply cared about Norma in some odd, twisted way. And I think it's also like his reclaiming of some type of control of his actions. Like he was kind of controlled by Norma because he would feel obligated to her because she bought him all these things and provided him with all these necessities and niceties as well. And he not only felt obligated, but he felt like... I guess even more obligated than you would in that situation, because she would also harm herself if you were to leave. And she threatened it. She actually did it when he did leave for the party. So it's really like this toxic, parasitic relationship taking place. And it's a horrible, horrible thing. Like Norma does realize what she's doing to him, but she is doing much worse to him than he did to her throughout the whole film.
Well, especially once he kills her or kills him.
We get to that point too. Yes. And that's logical because this is like her life. Her very soul is at stake when somebody says words about her that make a statement about her worth, I guess I'd say. And him leaving is him making a statement about what she means to him. And after she found out that the letters were fake, and obviously she ends up kind of blocking that out in her mind, because the next moment she's like, I'm a star, because it only took him saying I'm a star, and she latched onto that, right? She latched onto that so quickly because she knew, like, deep down she knew that those letters were fake, that they only wanted the Paramount only wanted to rent her car and didn't want to make her movie, and that her career was over. And unfortunately it led to her killing him because that obsession went too far, and she thought that when he was leaving, that was her killing him. No, him killing... She thought that when Joe was leaving, that was Joe killing her.
Right.
And so she needed to retaliate. So she killed him and shot him not only once, but three times. Like, she was thinking about it and kept doing it. And he falls in the pool and eventually gets the pool he wanted.
And then naturally, in her own style, she can't even come to terms with the fact that she did that.
Mm-hmm.
And gets into the catatonic state that we see her in at the end of the movie. What do you think about, like, the stylistic choice to start with the pool murder scene, and then, so you kind of know what's going to happen at the end of the movie, and then have Joe narrate? A lot of people are, like, anti-narration, so.
I don't know. It doesn't make sense, because he's like, yeah, then they bagged me up, you know?
I think that's sort of the noir flair of the movie, is the narration aspect of it.
Yeah.
The way that they start it with him being at the pool, I think that's kind of what leads it. That's what noir films did a lot.
I didn't mind the narration. It was a little odd to know that he died. And this film isn't about being shocking. It would have been more shocking if we didn't see him die.
Right, but that's not.
Because I would have not have expected it the whole time.
No.
So, yeah, and it is a sad film too, because it shows, like, even to a lesser extent, we all kind of fall into that trap that Norma falls into. Just the spiraling self-loving but also self-loathing toilet bowl. So unfortunately that's the nature that we're in. And I think for Joe to finally leave that behind was the turning point in the film, to kind of be like, these relationships are toxic, some people will feed into them. I mean, really, this is about toxic relationships. TikTok was right?
Yeah.
No, I'm just joking, but
Well, I think that's a good point you identified there, that self-loving and self-loathing are, like, intertwined with each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like, having a large view of yourself also increases how much you despise yourself when you're not receiving in Norma's case, what she thinks she deserves
yeah.
from other people.
Yeah, because she only loved herself when other people loved herself.
Right.
So she was really only loving what other people like. And I'm not a proponent of self-love even to a single degree. I'm saying she can't have both of those things in a healthy way. You can't have both I have value and I need the praise all the time. It reminds me of a quote from Michael Scott from The Office. He goes, he's like, I don't have a need to be liked. He's like, it's not like my need to be praised.
Well, yeah, and you can see, if you think about it, you can see the foolishness in complete self-love, because complete self-love will lead you to doing things that are, that
Hitler
should be regrettable. Yeah, Hitler.
That's just my first thought, Charlie Chaplin.
Because you will not be taking anyone's advice, you know, because you think that you know everything, and that since you're so self-sufficient, you don't need any opinions from other people, which is just foolish. We do need the opinions of wise people around us, and of course, at a higher level, like the guidance from God and the Holy Spirit, if you're a Christian. But to think that you could, even as a non-religious person, to think that you could, like, be a perfect person or, like, know everything on your own is, like, completely silly. But people fall into that because it's a way to cover up insecurities, and or maybe just ignore insecurities.
Yeah, and I'm surprised and we haven't used that word yet.
Complete self-loathing, on the other hand, is another type of self-obsession where you're obsessed with your...
Because it's still about you.
Yeah.
It's still about you. It's still like, I hate myself, but it doesn't mean that it's still not about you. And you brought up the word insecurity. It really is an insecurity. Like, she hasn't had anything to be secure in, so she tries to find her security in other people and their opinions. And that's probably, like, an easy trap to fall into in the Hollywood world, because the Hollywood world is built around cameras, right? It's built around the lights being on you. It's built around you being at the center, because you make the money, right?
Yeah, and you know what else? Yeah, that's what I was going to say. For the producers and the yes men, which are referenced, fame is a tool. Your fame is a tool for them to make money. They are not as famous as you, but a lot of the executives make more money than the celebrities.
Yeah.
And they make money on perpetrating, on pushing this idea of fame. They don't hate the gossip magazines and stuff, because when a movie comes out with this person's name on it, they know they're going to make money.
Mm-hmm. I mean, even Ms. Schaefer was like, it's more fun to work behind the camera.
Yeah.
And that's probably because you don't get to hate yourself behind the camera. Behind the camera, you can do whatever you want.
Yeah. And some people don't fall into the trap of fame. They fall into other traps, but they understand that the pitfalls, and they are completely fine with being anonymous or not as well known.
Mm-hmm. I mean, these are some of the things that actors nowadays fall into. I mean, just horrible, super sad story. Like, I think of Robin Williams, just a super sad story where he put his worth in other things, right? He ascribed his value based on what other people thought, and he ended up killing himself. It's a super, super sad story. I say that with heavy gravity. But also you have stories of actors who end up leaving, you know, the acting world because either they can't handle it or they think it's stupid. And then you have other actors that are, like, just playing into it until they die. They're constantly going to let it be about
Robert
themselves.
Robert De Niro, he'll probably go to his grave with being...
And the thing is, like, this, I mean, this is Robert De Niro's different because he might actually be one of the best actors ever.
But I'm just saying he will always be Robert De Niro. Like, there's no...
He'll go until he dies.
Yeah.
I think of, like, Kanye. I know Kanye is a musical artist.
But Kanye may be the most, like, interesting study of fame in modern times.
One of them.
Because his ascension into a God complex was so, like, on the nose.
Mm-hmm.
And then his sort of spiral, which it's hard to tell whether he's going up or down at this point. Maybe it doesn't even matter.
it's all the same.
But
his up is some others down, you know?
But because people, and even thinking about his music, you're like, some of it is great, but then should we really be saying, you know, this is the... By saying things like he's the greatest musical mind or producer, I mean, that's not really true. There's been many other great musicians in this time. A lot of people fed that, and then Rihanna. People turned on him, which I'm not saying that we should excuse his actions, because he did say some pretty reprehensible
things. We're getting to a lot of mental illness, Kanye's allegations.
But it is a bit ironic that a lot of the people who were quick to turn on him were probably the people who were enabling him to become the way he was. Now, he has to take blame for himself. This is not, but it's sort of one of those also reflect on yourself.
He has taken, he says, as much as Kanye loves Kanye, which is a lot. That's a lyric in his song, right? Yeah. So he knows he loves himself.
I love you. Yeah, isn't it? I love you as much as Kanye loves Kanye, which is a lot.
Yeah.
That's a big compliment if you say that to somebody.
Yeah, he's like, I love you as much as I love myself. And the woman's like, aw.
Yeah. I'm sure in 20, 30 years we'll get a nice biopic.
Oh, yeah. It'll be called Ye.
Maybe not even that long. Maybe like next year.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe it'll be directed by him.
A Pixar movie.
Wouldn't that be awesome?
Yeah.
Kanye directs a movie about his rise and fall.
That would be awesome.
And stars in it.
Yeah. He plays himself just like this film. A little meta. And then there's a film made off of it called Inland Empire. And it's the most famous movie that comes out of that film.
Yeah.
Because this film was really just a stepping ground for Inland Empire. Nothing else.
That's how we view it in the sands of history.
And the Lynchian everything perspective.
was Inland Empire the culmination of movies?
Inland Empire was. It was the culmination. This is the logical extension. This is the logical conclusion of where movies are heading.
So that's why we've gone down with the franchise stuff.
Yeah, because you can't go past that. It's the most multi-layered film that you could ever do, told in the most aberrant way, and you can't. It's hard to understand, and the only way to understand
it... You certainly can't copy it. Or no. It's hard to say that it would really influence much.
It's like, if we try to stretch out and make a film to push the most boundaries, then that film wins the medal. I don't know.
Big
I don't know what
award.
Phrases are.
Even though it definitely did not, because it did not get a lot of exposure.
I'm assuming most people who have started that film did not finish it.
That's funny with David Lynch, like... He like stood somewhere with like a cow trying to get Laura Dern nominated, which I would argue she did actually deserve a nomination for that performance. But
I think I said last night, all I remember from that film is Laura Dern, every single crease in Laura Dern's face because of those close up shots.
That's my
and her teeth.
Single least regretted purchase of all time. It was sort of on a whim. On Amazon.
Yeah.
Oh, it's like $27. It's on sale. I'll just buy it.
That's on sale?
Yeah.
Was it a steelbook?
No, it's a Criterion Collection.
They make those too much.
They do make those too much. That's why.
Because you can buy them anywhere else.
Yeah. There's like a day at Barnes & Noble's that they're like heavily discounted. But yeah, they're like $35 to $40 for each one.
And there are 1,600 at this point?
Yeah, there's tons.
Wow.
I need to figure out how to get my way into that closet where you get them for free. You get a video made about you. Like, that's how we know we made it when the movie vault picks out their Criterion movies. And we're there in that little closet picking out the movies. That's not going to be for a while, folks. So
yeah, next year. It's a whole year. We have to wait.
All right. Shall we conclude?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know what else to add. I think this film... We'll see how it influences the 60s. What year was this, 50?
1950.
So it's 10 years later. We're doing films in the 60s.
We're doing three films in the 60s, but they're also like two French films and an Italian film. So
whatever.
I mean, Hollywood influenced all those films.
Yeah, Hollywood's bigger.
Hollywood is bigger, especially like the French New Wave. But it's hard. I don't know whether we'll see. No. Actually, one of the movies, well, the one I've seen, maybe you could draw some references on Sunset Boulevard.
Yeah. Well, then... Just be sure to check our next film, which, spoiler alert, it has Buster Keaton. Should we say what it is?
Yeah, Sherlock Jr.
Which is a 1920 film?
I honestly don't remember. It's in the 20s. Don't remember what year.
Yeah. But we have two Buster Keaton films in a row, which is fun. I like that. 1924.
Yep. It's a quick watch, so if you have the time, sit down and watch
it. Oh, it's on YouTube. We could have watched it on YouTube.
Oh.
That's funny.
Oh, yeah, a lot of silent movies on YouTube we found. So,
also, if you want to crank out tons of movies on your Letterboxd. Just look up some old silent films that are like 5 minutes long or less.
Oh, that which reminds me, before I forget again, let's do some movie highlights.
Oh, yes.
Because I have so many.
Really?
Well, I do have some because I didn't.
Oh, last week.
We didn't do last one.
Want me to get my one out of the way?
Go ahead.
Or maybe I have more than one. That was a weird one.
I doubled my movie output in the last like 2 weeks and yesterday and today because I had only watched two movies.
Nice. I watched The Astronomer's Dream, George Méliès. That's the one that you watch. I watched The Dancing Pig. I'm going to give credit. Milliard Mercury, 1907. And then I've been watching a ton of Twin Peaks. Ratcatcher, I don't recommend it to other people. Just look at Letterboxd for my review. Honestly, I have nothing else to say about that. That's me.
Okay. For me, I watched South Park Bigger, Longer, and Uncut.
Okay.
I'm not going to lie to you. I was very disappointed by this movie.
Was it bigger, longer?
I haven't watched that much South Park. It's known for being a biting social commentary, not afraid to make fun of every aspect of society. But I found this movie to be just kind of gross. That's how I would describe it.
Hmm. I mean, based off the title.
So, I'll just say that one of the plot lines involves a relationship between Saddam Hussein and the devil. So,
okay.
And I didn't think about this, but Saddam Hussein was still very much alive at the making of this movie.
Great.
Which is kind of funny. But, probably could have watched 1,000 other movies or 1,000,000 other movies that would have been a better use of my time. But I watched it, so 2 stars on Letterboxd. Miller's Crossing is a Coen Brothers movie. It is a 1920s gangster film. And while I didn't find it to be one of my favorite Coen Brothers movies, as it didn't lean as much into like comedy as some of the Coen Brothers movies do, it was very well made, and it did have some very memorable scenes and good performances. John Turturro, who's later in The Big Lebowski, has a very fun performance. So it's I'd say it's probably more of a middle of the road Coen Brothers movie, but definitely worth your time. And then I've also been watching a lot of Twin Peaks.
Yeah, and we'll do a Outside the Vault on that, right?
Yeah. Well, ultimately, I would love this will be years down the line, but I would love to do a spin-off podcast.
Whoa, you're
where
thinking,
we just
whoa.
Do episode by episode.
Ben, for those listening, Ben hasn't even pitched this to me. This is a big a big revelation in the movie world.
Yeah. Ben wants now, to do a spin-off. I'm sure that there are no other podcasts that have ever done that before.
Really?
There are. But they wouldn't do it like we could. So, that's what matters.
The TV vault? I mean, what else? Well, sorry. I just
no, it would be
bottle.
That we would not do this about any other TV show, just Twin Peaks.
A Twin Peaks? Oh, really?
Yeah, like a Twin Peaks only. It's like...
Oh, I'm in.
Themed to Twin Peaks.
Oh, let's not wait years. That's a good idea.
Yeah.
Wait, can we cut this out? No, I'm very seriously considering cutting this out now.
We can cut it out. All right, so let's close the vault. All right, I'll shut it.
Wait, can I shut it?
Yeah, you shut it.
Wait, can you shut it and then I say the last thing?
Yeah. Dun, 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 boom, boom.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.